Welcome to Asia Calling, your window on Asia. Coming up on the show this week, Australia's First People are still searching for recognition in a country that has never come to terms with its violent past. We take a look at the latest push to acknowledge Indigenous Australians. We also speak to young South Koreans who are extremely educated but who are going through an unemployment ice age. And a hospital in the conflict-rattled Gaza Strip, which was built by Indonesians in a show of friendship and solidarity with Palestinians. Thanks for tuning into the show. I'm Nicole Kirby. Recent research shows that Aboriginal people have lived in Australia for more than 60,000 years. When the British colonised the country more than 200 years ago, they brought guns, disease and violence, and they took the land of Aboriginal people. Aboriginal people didn't cede sovereignty, and there has never been a treaty. Australia is still struggling with this violent past, and Indigenous people are still fighting for adequate recognition. In recent years, some have argued that Australia's First People should be acknowledged in the Constitution. From Sydney, Jake Atienza finds out more.
An Aboriginal man is busking on the streets of Redfern, Sydney. For decades, this area has been a hub for Aboriginal people and Aboriginal activism. Over the years, campaigns have been fought to end Aboriginal deaths in custody and to gain land rights. In 1967, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people were finally recognized as Australian citizens. But the Australian Constitution makes no mention of the country's First People, who are still among the most disadvantaged in the country.
We have the highest incarceration rate of any group of people in the world, it's said. There is a major problem of inequality health outcomes, of life expectancy, that type of thing.
That's Thomas Mayer. He was a delegate at the First Nations National Constitutional Convention. Since 2015, government-appointed delegates from Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities across Australia have discussed constitutional reform. They have debated if and how Australia's First People should be recognized in the country's foundational document, the Constitution. In June, the Referendum Council submitted its recommendations to the Australian government. The key recommendation is to hold a referendum where Australians will decide if the Constitution should guarantee a representative body for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders to have a say in the laws that govern them. Thomas Mayer explains.
The constitutional change that is being called for is a rather simple one. It's to provide an opportunity for Australia's Indigenous people to have a voice to Parliament by having a say on those matters that are being decided for them in legislature.
Previous bodies representing Indigenous people were not enshrined in the Constitution and have been repeatedly dismantled and reformed by government. And repressive policies targeting Indigenous people have been implemented without consultation. In 2007, following a report into child abuse, the army was sent into Indigenous communities to implement policies including curfews, bans on alcohol, and restrictions on welfare payments. Known as the intervention, the policy has been called a violation of human rights. Nicole Watson was a legal advisor at the recent talks and says Indigenous leaders want to ensure this doesn't happen again.
Because of measures like the intervention, that there is a sense now that Indigenous affairs is in complete disarray. And people are very anxious to get some means, I guess, that we and a framework for us to exercise self-determination, and preferably a framework that governments cannot take away.
But not all Aboriginal leaders agree that a representative body enshrined in the Constitution is the answer. Jenny Munro is from the Mudjingal Aboriginal Women's Centre in Redfern, Sydney. She is one of seven delegates who walked out of the talks in protest.
These bodies don't work for us because they're white constructions. We have our own system with our own constructions, and that's what's worked for us.
Jenny Munro wants to see more emphasis on Aboriginal people receiving compensation for the land that colonizers stole from them, and recognition of Indigenous systems of governance. The Referendum Council also recommends that Parliament pass a statement acknowledging that Indigenous people never ceded sovereignty. The Council also proposes a Truth and Justice Commission is established to facilitate treaty making between government and Indigenous communities. Both can be pursued by government without changing the Constitution. Jackie Huggins co-chairs the National Congress of Australia's First People. She says political viability is at the heart of ensuring an Indigenous voice in Australia's political process.
That if we're ever going to get anywhere, I think we have to fight them, use the white man's tools, as the great poet Audre Lorde said once, to dismantle the house, you know. So we have to fight them with their words, with their language, their vocabulary, because if we don't, we continue to be marginalised and on the fringes.
Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull hasn't formally responded to the Referendum Council's recommendations yet. But Jackie Huggins says she is confident that the current dialogue is a step in the right direction.
Hopefully Aboriginal and Torres Strait people can be elevated to a position of respect and dignity and a rightful place in our society that's never been there before.
For Asia Calling, I'm Jake Atienza in Sydney, Australia.
South Korea is experiencing what's being called an employment ice age. Young South Koreans are extremely well educated. Roughly 70% of those in their 20s and early 30s hold university degrees. But many of them still can't find jobs. The youth unemployment rate hovers at around 10%, well above the national average. And it's getting worse now that conglomerates like Samsung and LG say they're not increasing hiring this year. Smaller companies say they have plenty of jobs. It's just that no one wants to work for them. Reporter Jason Strother has more from Seoul.
Most mornings, Lee Sung-hoon takes the subway to Noranjin, a neighborhood filled with private academies that prepare students for the civil servants exam. His school is located in a seven-story building called the Mega Study Tower. Public sector jobs are known as the Iron Rice Bowl because even when the economy isn't so good, the government still hires, and it's very hard to get fired from these jobs. The country's new president, Moon Jae-in, has pledged to create thousands more of these public sector jobs for university grads. 23-year-old Lee Sung-hoon is studying engineering, but he says he's making a pragmatic choice to take time off and study for the civil servant exam.
It isn't that I think being a public servant is a good job, it's just a cure. Some of my friends want to earn a lot of money, so they'll try to work for a big conglomerate, but I prefer stability.
Neither engineering nor the civil service is his passion, he tells me.
Parents want their kids to get a good job, So you have to go to university. It doesn't even matter what you study. You just get into whatever major you can. Passion in life doesn't matter. And so you lose interest in where studying along the way.
For most South Korean families, the right kind of job is narrowly defined. That's according to Jasper Kim, who teaches at Ewha Women's University's Graduate School of International Studies in Seoul.
And here the right job is just a government job or working for one of these large conglomerates. It's one of the two. And so what parents do is they put all their resources, economic resources, emotional resources, into their kids to attain this goal.
Other Northeast Asian countries, like Japan and Taiwan, have dealt with high youth unemployment too. But Kim argues it's a bit different here. Korean parents try to ensure that their kids get the best jobs by not only sending them through university, but also spending lots of money on private education. There's an academy for almost every profession here. Kim says it's not statistically possible for all these well-educated people to land these desired positions, and that's what's behind Korea's rising youth unemployment rate.
Korea is suffering from basically having too much education. A class of young kids who are out there who just have too many degrees, has spent too much time in schools, and therefore it's triggered very high expectations, arguably an irrational exuberance of expectations in terms of what type of job to expect after graduation.
Kim says many college grads wouldn't consider working for a small or medium-sized enterprise, SME. But now that the big-name firms aren't creating enough jobs, some young Koreans are giving these smaller companies another look. I dropped by a youth job fair in Goyang City, just outside of Seoul, where about 50 SMEs were looking to hire on the spot. Some job seekers, like 27-year-old Choi Kang-min, came dressed in a suit and tie. He graduated earlier this year with a degree in automotive engineering and says he'd much rather work for a big company because he's only heard bad things about small ones.
I have friends who works at a small company and he's always working overtime. That sounds really bad to me.
Ha-gun, whose company makes cases for electric wiring, is recruiting at the job fair. He says SMEs like his have gotten an unfair reputation.
Job seekers here have this preconception that all SMEs exploit their employees. Yes, some do, but not all. I wish they can be more open to working for firms like ours.
Overworking their employees isn't the only thing that SMEs are known for. They pay a lot less than the big-name firms. That's why 23-year-old Han Yu-jung says she's hesitant to work for one.
My professor says if you work for a conglomerate, you'll earn in 1 year what it would take 10 years to make at a small company.
But Han adds that given her current job prospects, she'll take whatever she can get. For Asia Calling, I'm Jason Strother, Goyang, South Korea.
You're listening to Asia Calling KBR. Dragged at gunpoint into a dark world of sexual slavery from Indonesia to the United States, Chandra Wawarunto knows the true meaning of survival. After a lucky escape, 15 years later, Chandra is now an advocate, agitating for legislative change and promoting support services for survivors of human trafficking. I caught up with Chandra at the Ubud Writers and Readers Festival in Bali, Indonesia, and heard her incredible story. Chandra Wawarunto is graceful and dignified. As I wait for her, she's greeting dozens of people who are telling her that they are humbled by her courage. Chandra says she's driven to tell her story publicly, but that if I notice her fidgeting or stammering, it might be because she's having flashbacks. Memories of a devastating chapter in her life.
I came from a wealthy family and I graduated
from a wealthy family. Chandra Wawarunto received a good education, which led to a good career at a bank.
Work in the bank as a money market trader. And also
that's until the Asian financial crisis hit in 1997, massively devaluing the rupiah and causing her job to be axed. With a three-year-old daughter to support, Chandra looked further afield for work. That's when she saw an ad in Compass, a reputable Indonesian newspaper.
And then I saw a newspaper. The ad said 6 months work in U.S., Singapore, Hong Kong, Malaysia, Japan, something like that. So I decided to go to U.S. because of I know the power of U.S. dollar. And the fact is so many things that promise a nice thing, the goodness. So America became my dreamland.
Chandra went through all the legitimate channels and left Indonesia with a plan to work in hospitality.
So I paid $3,000 as requirement for employment fee. I have a paperwork. I went to the U.S. Embassy and I got my visa. I flew to the U.S. So arrival was smooth and someone have my picture and recognized me. And, "Are you Chandra?" I say, "Yes."
But as soon as she arrived, things quickly deviated from the plan and became a nightmare.
I didn't go to Chicago as a promise. He took me to somewhere and I was exchanged with money. And I counted it was five times. After that, with the gunpoint, because of I refused to open my clothes, he sent me to a brothel that ran by a lady trafficker. He said, "Mama-san, a new girl." So I realized I was sold.
When he said, "Mama-san,
a
new
girl." Yes, "Mama-san, a new girl." So I realized that it was a disaster. It was a problem, a big problem, that I was sold in the brothel for prostitution. And then I couldn't do anything because of the gunpoint. And I saw a security with a baseball bat swinging around the bat and scared me. Beside another hand, I saw a little girl beaten by those people and she was bleeding. And I saw untreated, wounded on her face. That made me so scared.
And the nightmare just kept rolling.
And at that day, few hours after my arrival, I was sold to sex buyer. In the morning, my trafficker took my passport and my return ticket and also my belonging. They said I had to pay $30,000 to be free from the job because they gave me that job. That's what he said. So every customer that I serve will deduct $100 from the debt. So it means I have to serve 300 sex buyers. So I think hard about the situation. I think they will not free me. They will not let me go.
Days became nights and nights became day, all filled with the blinding lights of casinos and the revolving doors of endless hotel rooms.
Candy. My name was taken. So they changed my name to be Candy.
Chandra doesn't know exactly how long this continued. Eventually, in desperation, she jumped out a bathroom window.
So I tried to escape many times, and then by jumping out from second floor bathroom windows, I was alive and still alive. It was amazing. It was a miracle. I stayed away. I ran from that place and I called this number in the morning.
Seeking help from a contact she'd been given, Chandra was tricked. And soon she was back in the hands of organized crime and at the brothel. Chandra wasn't free until she escaped for a second time. She went to the police and the Indonesian consulate seeking help. But both turned her away. They didn't believe her story. She was living on the streets, telling her story to anyone who would listen.
Finally, I met a US Navy at the park, and he said he will help me. And he called FBI.
The FBI verified her story and closed down the brothel she had been at. She was able to get her visa to legally stay in the country. So she moved into a shelter and started an English as a second language course and went to school. But Chandra was driven to work towards a world where what happened to her would never happen again. Chandra has an NGO called Mentari, based in New York and LA. Mentari works with survivors of human trafficking and sexual slavery.
So this is what we do. So we empower them to get the job and also integrate to the community. We equip them with mentorship, how to open bank account, how to shop, where to go, when we go to hospital, what to do, like life survival. Because of most of the people that brought to the United States didn't know how to survive in the United States.
Mentari also has links with partner organizations in Indonesia, where they are raising awareness of human trafficking and supporting survivors. For Asia Calling, this is Nicole Kirby in conversation with Chandra Wawaruntu in Ubud, Bali. The Gaza Strip is a tiny wedge of territory that sits between Israel, the Mediterranean Sea, and Egypt. It's a deeply contested area, and for decades it's been the site of intense conflict. With frequent Israeli military attacks on the area and a long-running economic blockade, Gaza's 20 million residents have suffered economically, physically, and emotionally. In a show of friendship and support, Indonesians raised money to establish a hospital in North Gaza, the area most vulnerable to attacks. And for the last year and a half, more than 300,000 people have benefited from medical care. Rami El-Ghamari has this report from Lede, Gaza.
The Indonesian hospital in Gaza sits on top of a hill just outside Jabalia, Gaza's largest refugee camp, and just 3 kilometers from the Israel border. In the hospital's waiting room, I meet 62-year-old Om Saddam, who is here to receive a treatment for kidney failure. She goes to hospital twice a week to get kidney dialysis. Their son, Saddam Sulaiman, tells me this hospital has made their lives much easier.
Before this hospital was built, she used to travel a long distance to a hospital far from our home. This hospital, in general, tends to be very comfortable.
The Indonesian hospital is so named because it was built with the money of Indonesian people who donated $9 million through NGO Medical Emergency Rescue Committee. The hospital is a token of a friendship between Palestine and Indonesia. As the world's most populous Islamic nation, Indonesia has long showed support for Muslim-majority Palestine. Indonesia's foreign policy supports an independent Palestine. With 110 beds, the hospital serves 300,000 people. Dr. Nasser Radwan, head of the surgical department, says the Indonesian hospital addresses an urgent gap.
In the past, there was no special surgeries in the north of Gaza. I mean by that, there was only general surgery without high specialty. There was no vascular or neurosurgery. The addition of the Indonesian hospital is the addition of vascular surgery was absent before, and the addition of urological surgery and the addition of neurosurgery.
The hospital was originally intended to provide specialist treatment and care for those suffering trauma in the wake of Israeli attacks. But Dr. Ashraf Al-Qidra, spokesperson for the Gaza Health Ministry, explains that it has become a general hospital offering medical services that Gazans once had to travel abroad for.
This hospital has become a leading medical utility in northern Gaza, whereas some important services has begun to be offered. This includes CT and MRI scans, as well as the various surgeries.
Located in northern Gaza, close to the Israel border, the hospital is in the area most frequently exposed to attacks from the Israeli military. Al-Qidra tells me that the hospital often receives farmers who have been hit by gunfire along Gaza's northern border. In the past 8 years, Gaza has been hit by 3 major Israeli attacks. The territory is also subject to a decade-long Israel-imposed economic blockade, which has left Gaza's residents deeply impoverished. 80% of Gazans receive regular food aid from the United Nations Relief and Works Agency. Mu'in al-Masri is a chief for media and public relations at the Indonesian hospital.
The hospital is open to all people of Gaza, with particular medical attention reserved for residents of the north. We have special surgery in the field of blood vessels. We charge very little for admission and emergencies. For example, an injection is priced at just 1 shekel, or 30 US cents.
Other allies, including United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, and Turkey, have also donated hospitals to the war-ravaged region. The Indonesian hospital is only hospital that provides training and education for graduates and students of medicine in Gaza. Since its opening, the hospital has been funded by the Palestinian Health Ministry, and there are now plans to add another story to the building and expand the hospital. For Asia Calling, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
That's all for this edition of Asia Calling. Our program today was produced at the studios of Radio KBR in Jakarta, Indonesia. To find out more about our show, send us a message on our Asia Calling Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at Asia Calling for more updates. You can now also podcast the show. Go to the iTunes store and search for Asia Calling to subscribe for free to the weekly episodes. And if you like what you heard, please leave us a review. I'm Nicole Kirby, back next week with more stories from Asia.